On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Huawei and ZTE get slapped, our networks get tapped, and the secrets of OS deployment get cracked. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for the following show is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 14, recorded October 15th, 2012. All tapped out. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech was brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, a powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by Social Media Solutions from SAP. If you're a social media manager at a large enterprise, gain insight and engage in social media in a systematic way with Social Media Solutions from SAP. Learn more at sap.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is put together. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, and I'm joined by a fantastic panel, starting with Mr. Brian Chi from ThinLinks and the University of Hawaii. Brian, how is Honolulu today?
It is absolutely peachy.
Peachy. I like peachy. Peachy's good. And speaking of peachy, or perhaps the opposite of peachy, it's our own tech grouch himself, Mr. Oliver Rist from InfoWorld. Oliver, where are you coming from? And, how is it over there?
It's Seattle. And what do you think it's like? Rainy, cold, as always. We had 10 minutes of summer, and now it's like this for the next 6 to 8 months.
It's always nice to hear your cheerful disposition.
Yes, thank you.
The optimist side of technology. And, we didn't bring you here just because you're another pretty face. We brought you here because we've got a slew of important news and events that we want to talk about, starting with Huawei and ZTE. Now, if you've listened to the news at all, even if you're not an enterprise geek, you know this story. Congress has come back and said that Huawei and ZTE cannot be trusted in the United States. And here's the gist of the story. They're saying that they can't guarantee that both of those countries are not under undue influence from Beijing, from China. There's a few questions about their business practices, about the fact that there are allegations of bribery and theft and copyright trolling. Brian, what's going on here?
Well, the whole issue is that they're taking whatever kind of agreements they have with corporations and bending them all out of shape. They can put, there's lots and lots of examples of corporations that are playing nice. I actually used to work for Fujitsu Limited in Japan, and I actually used IBM manuals to work on basically mainframe clones, but they were licensed mainframe clones, and actually Gene Omdahl was kind of heading up the division or started the division originally. So there's lots of precedents for license agreements to work nicely and to be good for both sides of the coin. But unfortunately, Huawei and ZTE seem to be ignoring the terms of the agreement and bending them all out of shape. And that's what the government's really concerned about. It's that they don't seem to respect intellectual property rights.
Can you give me a concrete example of that? So, I mean, I've heard the allegations too. I've heard that, for example, they had a licensing agreement with HP, but what did they do with that licensing agreement that makes it bad?
Well, you and I have both worked with Huawei on interop, so we've got to be a little careful.
Right.
We're not allowed to say a few things about our direct experiences with them, but outside of that, Huawei actually is extending certain, shall we say, microcode licenses onto platforms that I don't think they've licensed. So, you know, try out some of your hidden HP commands and see what happens on your Huawei switch.
Right. That's actually... It's something fun that we found out, which is there are certain commands that work on pieces of gear from Huawei that shouldn't work, which it's kind of a, you know, it's hand in the cookie jar. It's saying, look, you used code here and you weren't licensed to use it except for in that product. Now, Oliver, there's been a complaint that this is really just protectionism, that this is the United States government trying to make up for a lack of innovation in U.S. companies over the last couple of years. You've got Huawei, who has turned into the world leader, the global leader in telecom equipment. You've got ZTE and Huawei in a partnership that is the number one deployer of 4G technologies. Is this protectionism, or is there a valid complaint?
Well, I think it's a double-sided coin. I mean, I think I think it was ZTE who pointed it out. Congress, they have, 73 members in Congress who were Cisco investors. That doesn't look too good. But on the other hand, Cisco's had to drop ZTE because they were selling Cisco equipment to Iran against U.S. sanctions. I'm not sure anybody's really clean here. So as far as I'm concerned, I would go with the U.S. government at this point and just wash your hands.
Right. Yeah. That's the feeling that I'm getting here. And again, I'm the same boat as Brian. I've worked with Huawei at Interop. So there are certain things that on a professional level, I won't talk about. But I will say that we've heard for years about, you know, these outlandish stories that must be fanciful, but then they turn out to be true, of Huawei employees outright stealing a design or taking pictures of a competitor's design while visiting a plant. You know, they're anecdotal, and so they're hard to take at face value. But when you hear them over and over and over again, and then, you know, I actually spoke to someone who has worked extensively with Huawei, and he was trying to explain to me how there's actually a cultural difference in how business is done in telecom in Asia or in other countries other than the United States, where it's sort of, well, anything goes. Business is war. And so if a competitor is going to do something silly like letting us see their microcode or letting us see their designs, why wouldn't they take advantage of it? Brian, listening to that, I mean, what's going to be the overall effect? Just because Congress says that we should be wary of using Huawei and ZTE equipment, that doesn't necessarily mean that companies in the United States or in the Western world will just stop, right?
Well, here's the biggest piece that concerned me. Huawei equipment phones home. You know, that's the bottom line. Now, if I actually think Lenovo is probably the better example here. Lenovo got slammed by this when they originally got bought from IBM, and people are concerned that the laptops are going to start stealing confidential information. And Lenovo went to great measures to say, hey, no, it's not. We're using the same kind of BIOSes and all that. We've modified a little bit, but we're not phoning home. And they actually went to some pretty extensive lengths to prove that they're not. Huawei has the same opportunity here because they do have valid licenses for certain types of microcode. Now, if they use that microcode to kind of jumpstart themselves and then start learning about it and actually earning the innovation, then I don't think anyone would have problems with them being part of the world economy. But when you go and wholesale just duplicate someone's equipment right down to hidden commands, you know, things like HP logos pop up in certain commands. This is not a good thing. You know, earn your technology. Don't wholesale copy.
Oliver, let me throw it to you. Brian seems to be saying that, okay, well, at one point Huawei will grow up and they'll learn how to play by the rules of the world, and then they'll be accepted because they will have earned their technology, they will have earned their status in the field. But is there another way to look at it? Dshale in the chat room said, look, it's the art of war. And what if Huawei doesn't do that? What if Huawei continues to do business the way that they're doing business right now, and they continue being the largest telecom vendor in the world? Could they just conceivably keep doing what they're doing and the rest of the world adopts to their matter of business?
The rest of the world has already adopted their manner of business. That's how business is done. They're already part of the world economy because they practice business like this. And let's face it, we're not exactly innocent in this type of practice either. We just cover it up better.
Okay, actually, good point. Good point. I want to bring that to both of you. This sort of wholesale copying of equipment is not limited to Chinese companies. We've seen it, and I won't name out any companies because I don't want to be accused of libel or slander here. But we've seen it in other companies. And it seems to be more accepted. And that kind of lends credence to the whole idea that this is just protectionism because we're scared at the industrial might of China. What do you think?
I mean, everybody quotes what Apple, right? They did it. Microsoft did it, right? They just made sure that they had a congenial environment in which to do it, but it really doesn't change the fact that they took technology that wasn't theirs, and built a $1 billion business on it. So, if Huawei is falling, I can't pronounce that name,
Huawei.
If they're following anyone's business practice, it's probably ours.
Jibert, is this a matter of they're growing up and they're going through that phase at which they're copying, but eventually they're going to start making their own equipment, their own innovations, and then everything's good?
One would certainly hope so. You know, if industry slaps them hard enough and say, hey, you know what, if I was going to do this, why don't I just go and buy it from HP or Cisco? That might change things. But I think the point that Congress is more worried about is money costs money, and startup funding is not free. And Congress is really concerned that Huawei seems to have magically gotten a massive, massive pot of money and suddenly are able to throw their money around. They're throwing millions and millions of dollars around at trade shows, press events and things like that. They're literally trying to buy the market. Now, I know this is right out of the playbook of some of the larger corporations in America, but, you know, where'd the money come from? That's the concern. When you start having a nation state backing a corporation, where are the strings attached? You know,
can I just say Halliburton?
Please. Oh, okay,
or
fine.
Boeing?
Halliburton.
Boeing? You know, this is not a new argument. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon, right? We've always had accusations across national boundaries of you're supporting this company with tax breaks or with incentives. And it seems unfair, except when yours is the country that's doing it. So, I mean, where does this fit on the scale of, on the top of the scale, you've got a country that basically owns a multinational corporation. And on the bottom of the scale, you've got tax breaks. Where does this go in between?
Well, to be fair to Brian, I wouldn't say it's an unhopeful situation, right? I mean, we understand in this country that Halliburton got an unfair deal, right? We're not really doing anything about it, but at least it was publicized.
So we just want transparency.
No, I think we want it not to happen, but we'll take what we can get.
Okay, I don't want to beat this into the ground. This isn't going to go away. I mean, Huawei, ZTE are huge companies. And even with this warning from Congress, I don't see their business model slowing down any. I mean, if they can make decent equipment for lower prices than their competitors, people will continue to buy their gear, especially if they're the only player in the 4G space. So expect to hear more about Huawei, more about ZTE, and more about U.S. telecom companies kind of scrambling to find a response. Now, I do want to take a moment here to pause and talk about one of our sponsors, one of the great groups that helps keep Twiat on the air, and that is Citrix with GoToMeeting. Now, meetings are essential to the way that we work. We need them to listen to ideas, to critique, to discuss, to imagine. We also need meetings because we want to keep team members on task, on target. We want to focus them. We want to be able to see people face to face and say, look, you're doing exactly what you should be doing, or could you try focusing your attention more here? I mean, that's why we meet. That's why we discuss. And it's a good thing. But what happens when your team is spread out? What happens when your project spans a building or a city or a country or the world? Now, you could live in airports and on airplanes, jumping from one destination to the next. You could demand that your team come together to meet you, robbing them of precious time and resources. Or you could use GoToMeeting with HD Faces, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with clients and coworkers online. Now, I just had a great example of using GoToMeeting to great effect. We had a meeting of Jesuits here in Santa Cruz at a retreat house that we have up in the mountains. And, well, it involved about 40 people, but they were all around the world. They were in Chicago, New York, Atlanta, Beijing, Manila, down in South America. It would have been prohibitively expensive to fly everybody in. So instead, we got the five core members of our group to meet at the retreat house. I set up GoToMeeting with a very nice, easy to set up a configuration, a couple of web cameras, a couple of screens. And we had meetings for 5 days with everyone on the team. It worked well. It was easy to use. I don't think anyone had as much as a need for a technical support call to set it up on their PC, their Mac, or their tablet. It was that easy. I just sent out a series of invitations over email, and GoToMeeting took care of the rest. Now, here's the big thing. There's a thing that if you are running your own business, this you should take note. Using GoToMeeting for this one instance saved my department about $15,000. $15,000 in travel fees and hotel fees. If it could do that for us in one meeting, just imagine what it could do for you. Now, here's what I'd like you to do. I want you to visit GoToMeeting. I want you to try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Don't wait. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Be sure to use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I received an email from a viewer of the show, Mr. Ryan Jones. Ryan is a self-proclaimed newly minted administrator. And in his email, he talked about how he had inherited a huge network, a network that was way more complex and way more diverse than he had experienced before from another network administrator, and how he had spent the last 7 months just trying not to break it. Now, he did say that he was able to not break anything, but he was intrigued by our episode, our data closet episode about taps, about what they could take out of the network, about the information that we could get. But he wanted a more basic primer on what taps are, how we use taps, and how taps might help him. I got an email saying this: I find myself extremely lost when it comes to being more proactive about monitoring things. Right now, I seem to be spending time fixing things as they break or when a link gets congested and we start experiencing issues. Thanks to Twyatt and a day spent at Interop, I've started getting better at my day job. I'd like to learn how to use span ports and network taps and also how I should be using them. Well, Ryan, you're in luck because we've got an episode of Stuff My IT Guy Says.
I'm sitting next to Aaron Ingerbretson from Annette Optics, who's going to explain to us a little bit about what it means to get data out of your network. Aaron, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Now, tell me, how do I get data out of my network and why do I have to?
The reason you're getting data off your network is to analyze that traffic, figure out what people are doing, if there's servers that are acting up and you need to take care of them. Lots of reasons to look at that network traffic. To do that, there's three major ways to get traffic off your network. Okay. Number one is you can put a monitoring device in line.
Right.
Number two, you can pull a span port off of the switch that you're all plugged into. And number three is to install a tap.
Number one and number three sound similar in that you're putting a device into the network, into the connection between two different devices.
Right.
But we know that's not the same. What is the difference between number one and number three?
So number one is putting that device in line. If that device fails, network traffic stops.
Whereas with a tap,
right, you install a tap into your network between those two devices. If anything were ever to happen, a power failure, doesn't matter, network traffic will continue to pass.
And of course, here at Interop, we would always, always, always use method number three because you don't want a single point of failure to take down the entire network.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, That explains why I'd go with number three over number one. But what about number two? Explain this span port. What is that?
All right, so a span port, this is a terminology typically used with Cisco switches.
Okay.
It can also be used as a mirror port, more commonly known if you have an HP environment,
right?
Which basically means you're taking that traffic going on that switch and you're sending it over to another port. And then that port has all the replicated traffic you then forward to your tool.
What are the distinct advantages and disadvantages of spanning or tapping?
All right. So spanning is very simple to set up.
Few commands, boom.
Few commands and you're done. You know, a tap, plug it in, you're also done. Everyone uses spanning, and spanning is still used even in a tap environment. There's still valid reasons for it. However, there are a lot of limitations now to span ports, such as a switch is made to switch packets back and forth around the network. It is not made as a monitoring tool. So if you oversubscribe or you start to really use the CPU cycles on that switch, first place it's going to drop packets is to the span port.
Right.
Which is great if you're the network guy, really bad if you're the monitoring guy.
Even though we use both spanning and tapping, we understand that you're going to want taps in place, because if there starts to be a network event, if you are oversubscribing a switch, if you are overloading a particular segment of the network, that's not the time to lose your monitoring.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Right. And one other big reason to go with a tap instead of span is when there are CRC errors or there's errors going on within your packet, Layer 2 switches are made to drop those packets and request that packet again, saying something is wrong with this packet, send me another. Well, if those keep happening and the switch keeps dropping them, how is the monitoring guy ever going to know what's going on?
Because of the function of a switch, it can actually disguise some of the network problems that a tap could pick up.
That's right.
Now let's focus on taps because, NetOptics and taps are almost synonymous. You were involved in taps way, way back. It's in your DNA. Explain to me what the philosophy of taps is for NetOptics.
All right. Well, so the philosophy for taps is not to be a point of failure in your network. Mm-hmm. But build these things robust.
Right.
If you even notice on a fiber tap, there is not even a power supply. These things just work. Mm-hmm. It's adding like 6 inches of cable. And what we're doing is we're splitting off a portion of that fiber light, and we're sending out to the monitoring tools.
Right. Yeah. And I actually even works the same way for the copper, which is it's got power adapters here, but if you were to pull these off, you could still pass traffic through.
Exactly.
It's designed not to be that single point of failure within your network.
Exactly.
Could you please explain the differences between the different types of taps we've got on the table? We've got this one tap that has four ports. It has A, B. We've got a fiber tap that seems to be the same. And then we've got a different type of tap over there. What are the differences between styles of taps?
So let me show you on, say, this is our fiber. This is a 10 gig fiber tap right here. This is what we're using in the show this week. So what you have is you have A, B, and that is your network device 1 and your network device 2. And you sit between the two network devices. That traffic on A is replicated out the A port here. And on B, replicate out the B port. So now you have these two ports, which are both transmitting data.
Okay, so you could see one side or the other.
Right.
Now, I could see the usefulness of that, but really, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to split the traffic like that?
Well, a lot of people don't really understand that on a 1 gig link, there's a potential of 2 gig of traffic.
Right. That's in both ways.
Right.
If you were to combine the two and you were to max out each direction, you wouldn't get all the packets.
Right. Yeah. That whatever you're looking at on that one port would just be dropping packets.
And that same philosophy is continued in this. We've got A, B, and then we've got A, B, so I can watch each direction at line speed.
Right.
Now, that tap is slightly different. Explain that.
So this is what we call an aggregating tap.
Okay.
So this is where we take the traffic from network device A and network device B. We replicate it out one port. So by doing this, this is great for a field application.
Yeah, that's right. I was just thinking that.
Yeah. Right? You want to look at the traffic. You tap it, and your laptop only has one NIC on it. So now you're going to see both sides of traffic on one NIC.
Different taps for different needs.
That's right.
All right. Now, we are going to be doing a further review of these taps. NetOptics was nice enough to send a few to our lab, and we're going to show our audience exactly what kind of data they can pull off using tools like Wireshark. I'm Father Robert Ballas here, and you've just been learned.
I have to confess, I love messing with taps. That's why I kind of stole these from NetOptics. Sorry, guys. I promise I'll get them back to you probably at some point. But Cheebert, what are taps in shorthand, in geeks, layman's terms? What are what does a tap do for you?
Think of it as a magic mirror that allows you to watch what's going on in your network. If someone's going and sticking a whole bunch of gear in there, just willy-nilly, sometimes you introduce some weird incompatibilities or some weird timing errors. And taps give me the ability to go and watch what's happening at the protocol level. Little things like just watching the timestamps. How long does it take for something to reply? I can't tell you how many times a web application is just timed out. And a tap goes and tells me, gee, that acknowledgement came outside of the specifications. Maybe that application on the web server is way overloaded and I need to rethink how we've deployed that. Taps give me that view directly into the protocol that a lot of other instruments don't give me.
Good. And that gives us the technical view. But for the more business-oriented view, Oliver, I know you've covered this a lot in your writings and in your dealings with networking enterprise gear. What is the typical response of an IT professional who may not be using a network monitoring tool every time there's network congestion? I mean, what's the first knee-jerk response if someone doesn't know what's going on in the network but is having trouble delivering what they need to deliver?
So what you want to look for is your IT guy saying the phrase, wow, that's interesting. That means everything is dead and you're pretty much hosed. So what you get a lot less of that with devices like this. And I think any business person who requires, which I think is every business person at this point, for the network to maintain uptime as long as possible, should put budget aside for this and other network monitoring devices. And guys like Brian, who can, they do what I do. I give him a tap and he explains to me what's going on, and then he fixes it and I get to keep reading my magazine.
Right, exactly. Now, I do want to say a couple of the guys in the chat room have mentioned that they've been dealing with network monitoring tools before. These are the two taps that I actually used in that pre-recorded episode. The bottom one is an aggregating tap. So this is the one where we have an A side and a B side, and all the traffic is replicated out of a single port. So I could you could use it in the field. You plug it into a network link and get all the traffic going in both ways. The top one is this is actually the one that we used for the data closet edition of the taps a few weeks back, where we have an A side and a B side, and we can tap just the A side or just the B side. They're both taps, but they have very distinct uses. In one sense, in this one, we're trying to get all the traffic going over the network, and in this one, we're trying to get just one direction. Different types of taps for different circumstances for troubleshooting. Cheebert, where would you use the top tap and where would you use the aggregating tap?
Well, a lot of times, voice. Voice has got to be one of the most persnickety technologies on the face of the earth, even today. And you need to know which direction the problems are happening. So having it aggregate, you can aggregate, you can go and dig through the packets. But sometimes you just want to have a quick, fast view into one side or the other. Now, here's the downside to aggregating taps. If you have a gig aggregating tap, that means in theory that aggregation port could potentially hit 2 gig per second because you've got a gig in each direction. If you only have a gig interface, that means everything goes to hell. This is one of the reasons why aggregating taps have been a problem with some court cases where, a lawyer has gotten people off on some kiddie porn cases because you couldn't prove that what got dropped in an aggregating tap wasn't something that would exonerate the person. So what we did was write a nice paper that the judges now use to say, hey, if you correlate this with the flow information off your switches, you will know when it's going to start dropping packets, and you can testify in court that, yes, that critical information didn't get dropped. So they both have their purposes. Aggregating taps do introduce a slight amount of latency, not a whole lot, but just a slight amount. regular taps introduce damn near no latency. In fact, I don't think they introduce any latency at all. And taps in general do not reclock packets, because that's one of the key things that you're looking for when you're dealing with the packet level.
I do want to mention one thing out of the chat room, because someone was, I think they were making a joke, but they were wondering, well, what happens when your essential tap fails and kills the network? If it's a well-designed tap, like the NetOptics taps, NetScout, Gigamon, they all fail closed, so that you could blow up the unit. You could take out power. You could kill the electronics inside. It will continue to pass packets. It will continue to pass light. That's what they've been designed to do. That was actually one of the points of the video. Chibert, quick question from the chat room I saw a while back about span ports. Someone asked, well, you know, if span ports are built into my switch, why wouldn't I just use that? It seems like an unnecessary expense to want to buy a tap.
Actually, a lot of people do use span ports because of that very reason. They're either free or really, really cheap, depending on how you slice it. The problem with span ports is they can get really oversubscribed in a big, fat, freaking hurry. Span ports, a lot of times, depending on what switch operating system you're using, can only span one VLAN at a time or one port at a time. So typically what a lot of people do is if they use a span port, they'll span a trunk port so you can see all the traffic. Sometimes you want to see a little less. Sometimes you want to see a little more. But span ports do have their limitations.
Yeah, they do. And actually, we've seen that at Interop. In the chat room right now is Interop One, who is the lead engineer of Interop. He's the guy who helps us put it all together. He designs the network. And so if there's anyone else in the chat room with a question about taps, ask him. He'll be able to tell you. Now, let's go on quickly. You mentioned voice. I want to talk about voice here in the Brick House, because when we built this new studio, we decided that we wanted to do as much as possible through the cloud. We didn't want a big old PBX system in the basement, and so what we decided was that we should push our voice into the cloud, just as we push our documents and our scheduling and pretty much everything else that we do here at the Brick House. Well, when our IT guy, Russell, told us that we could get a cloud-based phone system through RingCentral, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. Zero startup cost, no PBX hardware to speak of to maintain or install. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling. Our producers get their emails and their voicemails in one convenient inbox, and we can even get all of our fax messages right on our mobile devices. Now, here's what we want you to do. We want you to try the same kind of cloud-based telephony bliss that we have here at the Brick House by going to RingCentral. They offer a all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. And for a limited time, for every phone that you buy, you get another one free, up to 20 phones. They have a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. So call today. Designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, 800-543-9980. Or you can also go to ringcentral.com and use promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to the meat of the episode. We're talking all about OS deployment. Now, this is really, really germane right now because we've got the pre-release of Windows 8. It's out in stores. You can buy your copy, have it shipped to you when it's ready to go. So we need to ask ourselves, well, what happens when we deploy new operating systems in the enterprise? I want to start with Oliver on this one. Oliver, when you've got an enterprise that is considering an upgrade, and we've just seen the upgrade from XP to Windows 7, what typically are the decisions that have to be made before you undertake such a major endeavor?
Wow.
And a simple question.
No, it's a simple question. It's one we seem to answer every 2 years when Microsoft puts out a new product platform. So I'm hoping people remember it, but in case they don't, yes, you have to weigh the pros and the cons. Pros and the cons are generally about your line of business applications. I think that's one of the reasons Microsoft has started releasing the new version of Office at the same time that they released the new version of Windows, because frankly, in my opinion, my humble opinion, Office is what moves Microsoft along, right? That seems to, there's actually, in my mind, almost no compelling reason to upgrade from one Windows to the next on the desktop side, unless you're getting some new functionality that you need in a line of business app. And I think the largest productivity business app in the world, I don't have the numbers, but I'm pretty sure it's going to wind up being Microsoft Office. So you have to weigh the pros and the cons, right? Do your employees need these new functions? You have to evaluate your LOBs, your line of business apps, and decide, is it something that they need? Will we have to upgrade our that software if we move to a new platform, and how much is that going to cost? It's really not about licensing, right? I think licensing usually winds up being the cheapest component of an upgrade. It's about consulting costs. It's about LOB service costs. It's about testing. It's about, then, of course, there's user training. It goes on and on. These are the things you have to look at and then weigh against the possible benefits before you decide to move.
Achiever Castle Bravo in the chat room has a great comment. He says he'll install Windows 8 when he's ready to get fired. Is this what it's come down to? I mean, we've heard a lot of bad press. And personally, I like Windows 8, but I'm thinking that I'm going to hold off in the enterprise. What is the thing that's going to push people to Windows 8? And might it have something to do with the device you're holding in your hands?
Yeah, this is a pre-release copy of Windows 8. It's from Kingston. It's actually called the Data Traveler Workspace. If you've been playing with Linux, this is basically just like a live distro. You can boot it and it comes up with a full copy of Windows 8. But most importantly, it's a full copy of Windows 8 that you can install certain things to the read-write partition for things like contractors. Instead of having to go and set aside a complete machine, you can implement group policy on this so that they can't get to the local hard drives, but they still can set up VPNs back to their shop and things like that. I'm actually taking a really hard look at using that and put some Citrix clients on there so that students at the School of Architecture don't have to install a full big giant copy of Revit, which is a pig. They just go and boot this off on their laptops or whatever, run Windows 8, and then create the Citrix connection back into a virtual machine. So I think this is actually going to change the way a lot of people handle visitors, kiosks, little things. Instead of having to move, or instead of having to have a full machine, just move the USB drive.
Now that's interesting, because it brings back a previous topic from the show, that of virtualization. I think Oliver's right. You know, enterprises only want to look at ROI, and they're only going to do it if the expenditure for training and deployment is going to be surpassed by whatever return you're going to get on that. What does virtualization do to that ROI, Oliver? I mean, if it's that much easier for individuals within an enterprise to start using a new operating system without having to revamp the entire infrastructure, does that possibly make adoption a little bit easier?
I would think so, as long as, I mean, some of the value adds that Brian is mentioning, they sound great to you and me, because at least we're semi-geeky. Try walking into a CFO's office and pitching that there. You know, you have to have a very, very compelling argument for those guys to think about any kind of upgrade, because they've probably been through several, and they've probably seen costs spiral out of control, and then they've probably seen the benefits that they expected to see not really come into fruition. So if you have compelling business cases to do what Brian's talking about, then as an IT guy, you really have to cost it out. I've been at too many meetings with IT guys who run in there like Brian just did and say, this is really cool, and then they don't prep for the fact that the CFO has no clue what they're talking about. And they wind up losing the budget increase or the budget ask, whatever that might be.
Chibert, what about that? Is this just sort of a geek pipe dream? I mean, I love the ability to upgrade my operating system with a USB drive, to try different operating systems. I could have a different distro, a different live image for pretty much every operating system I want to run. But does that become useful in an actual enterprise where people are not as tech savvy as the army of geeks?
Well, the technology isn't so much concerned about that USB drive. That's just a way of delivering it. The whole concept is, let's get into virtual devices. InteropONE just threw out an email to me saying that this type of technology, VDI, is going to be very key to the trading environment. I'm already starting to see that on Wall Street. Oliver, you saw some of it when you were in New York. Mm-hmm. But the healthcare and finance people are absolutely going ape over thin clients. And something like this means that contractors can come in and still use the equipment, but without the IT people for a finance group going and hitting the ceiling.
T-Bert, I want to ask you this. Give me your dream scenario for an enterprise. Let's say your campus at the University of Hawaii in Manoa. What would a deployment of thousands of Windows workstations look like for you? I mean, what would be the easiest way for that to happen? What would be the most effective way to do that deployment?
Well, right now, you know, anyone that deploys a lab at a major university is using something like Norton Ghost, especially Norton Ghost Enterprise, where you can use multicast and you just boot from a floppy or a CD on a whole bunch of machines. And hopefully you have gig and gig switches and you go in maybe a couple, 3, 4, 5 hours later, your machines are imaged and you hope nothing screwed up. That's still a lot of work. That's still a lot of machines. And the thick client is still very expensive. You know, it's a very large part of people's budget and you can't afford to upgrade. You try and, you know, run it out as far as you can. Thin clients mean I can, Oliver, be quiet.
Sorry.
Thin clients give you the ability to just go and run a gold image of, you know, make your one perfect machine, and then deploying it is really fast. So what I'm looking at is, if I have a professor that has something kind of unusual, I will actually try and set it up so that the students can log in. They'll get a menu saying I'm in class such and such, and it'll actually launch a different VDI image for those students. That's not something that was easy to do in the old days. VDI has the potential for really making a big, big, big difference for education, but it also means that trading floors can have different images for the different people. They might be trading in different sectors. It also means that if a machine goes down on the trading floor, you're just swapping out a thin client. They still have their virtual desktop still running, still executing their trades in the background. So there's a lot of things that can start happening. In a perfect world, hopefully we'll start seeing some large monitors, the so-called smart TVs. We're going to start seeing them able to run Citrix clients and remote FX clients and things like that, so that any TV in a boardroom or a meeting room can be a full thin client and be able to get to your virtual desktop environment.
Now, I do want to mention that we figured out what's going on here on the set. We are having issues. Probably because we're talking about Windows and I did not have Mary Jo Foley on the show. So Mary Jo, I'm very, very sorry. Please stop doing whatever it is that you're doing right now. Thank you. Thank you very much. Oliver, I want to throw this over to you. This is cool. I like the idea of thin clients. It makes sense to me. It makes sense that if I can deploy Windows 8 or the next version of Windows or a version of Linux without having to worry about, going to each and every single machine, without having to worry about a huge expense, of course, it's something that I would want to do. But let me take your cranky geek view of this. Is this something that's enough to convince execs that they should upgrade to Windows 8 or even whatever's next?
One short answer, no. Longer answer, it's because partially people are still used to a fat client, right? I don't want to give up my fat client is kind of my world. So if you have a business case for doing what Brian was talking about, which in his industries, trading, financial trading and the medical industry, they certainly do. But for the general business user, that's going to be a tough call because they're going to feel that they're being limited by the virtual client. And two, Microsoft just for Windows 8, actually, they're doing demos about how you can deploy the fat client off a USB stick in 30 minutes, and that's with your data and all your apps, right? You can go from Windows XP or Windows 7 to Windows 8, stick a USB drive in, wait 30 minutes, and you're done. Hmm. Now, right, so that kind of, as far as the deployment angle, that kind of shoots you in the foot. And if a CFO looks at his little notebook and decides this is my, you know, I have it all set up the way that I want it, and I bothered the IT guy till he cried, and now I have what I want. Now he's talking about taking everything away, deploying what he wants, whatever. This is what that sounds like, right? So if you're going to pitch this to your boss, you have to have a very compelling and be a very detailed
description of the experience, right? Make sure that they know that just because it's a virtualized environment doesn't mean that they're losing any of the functionality, doesn't necessarily mean that they're losing any of the personality of what they have now.
Chibrit, what about that? I mean, okay, I understand where Oliver's coming from, and I understand why, well, his answer makes sense. They're not going to upgrade just because it's cool tech. So I want to throw to you the question of what is the thing that would have them upgrade? If not to Windows 8, then to the next one. What's the killer feature? What's the next big deployment? What's the next thing that enterprise must have that will spark the investment in either a fat client or a thin client upgrade?
Actually, it doesn't have to be one or the other. Microsoft just announced that they will be back revving Remote FX to Windows 7. Most importantly, it's Remote FX over UDP. So translated, this means you can run a remote protocol that can still leverage a graphics processor in the server, and you can do it over a wide area network, even a 3G. The important part about this is you can still have your fat client, but not everybody wants to go and install a massive 3D rendering program that's going to suck up your entire hard drive and so forth. You want to be able to just go and bring it up as an application window, do the run, get the information you need, close it up, and then say goodbye to it until, say, next month when you've got to do it again. Being able to have that application window pop up as a virtual desktop, not necessarily a whole desktop, but a virtual app, that is going to make life really interesting. And that's going to be the compelling business case that's going to give our CFOs the return on investment that they really want. Because now, instead of having to blow, $6,000-$7,000 on a copy of Revit for everybody, and that everybody runs it maybe once a month, wouldn't it be nice for that to be tied to a virtual desktop, run it on that virtual desktop, and share that amongst our lighter users? It's going to take a little bit of money off the plate of someone like Autodesk, but in grand total, it's going to be a net gain for them because they're going to be able to go into environments that they weren't normally able to go into.
Okay, so Chibrit, I get what you're saying. I want to give the last word to Oliver. Listening to Chibrit and listen to his admittedly very, he's got an optimistic view of where thin clients can take us. He's got an optimistic view of where future deployments could take us. Even if we're not talking about Windows, what is your bottom line to a IT exec or to a CFO, a CTO, if they're starting to look at an operating system upgrade, an operating system deployment across the enterprise?
I think Brian just made the point that I was asking for, right? In that situation, he made a very clear-cut, value-add, bottom-line, dollar-oriented argument about why you should at least think about the upgrade. You didn't have time to do the math, and that's very individual, but that's the upgrade conversation. You as an IT manager, if you are willing to move to Windows 8, and a lot of them aren't, because I think the largest install base of Windows is still Windows 2003 or 2000 Professional, Office 2003, Server 2003, right? There's a lot of that's based on IT pros. They don't see it, why fix it if it isn't broken? So if you have an argument like what Brian just had, that's what you need. You can't just say, it's good for being good. And by the way, Brian, your Remote FX argument, I remember you and I were in the car and you were, I won't say crying, but you were, lamenting the fact that so far there don't seem to be a lot of server-side video cards, period, right? I don't know if that's changed, but if you're going to attempt to talk your boss into doing an upgrade based on something like that, you better prove it out. So a proof of concept and a well-reasoned, thought-oriented, a cost-oriented pitch is what you're going to need.
Chibrit, were there tears?
No. It was very depressing, though. Our friends at ATI finally have an entire series of cards specifically for Remote FX. And Citrix has finally fessed up that anything, just about any GPU that runs CUDA cores is available. So it ain't great yet, but it's getting better.
And that's just good for the enterprise. And what else is good for the enterprise? Staying aware of what's going on in social media. These days, it's all about social. If you're not doing business with social media, then you're not really doing business. Right now, there are brands whose worth is being decided by what's being said on Twitter, on Facebook, on blogs. These strings of social media can determine the ultimate success or failure of any particular brand or product, and so enterprise needs to stay on top of it. But if you are a worker working with social media in a large enterprise, that can be a daunting task. Not just because of the sheer volume of content coming over social media networks, but because you need to be able to quantify it, qualify it, and respond to it. And that's why we're talking to our friends at SAP. The social media solutions from SAP helps large enterprises use social media with their listening and engaging components. The listening component searches the social web to gather what is being said about your brand, but it does it in a smart way. It captures and reports on conversations about relevant terms, passions, patterns, and competitors. It surfaces sentiment and the intensity of it. For example, do your customers love, like, or dislike something connected to your brand? It helps you identify customers who are ready to buy based on buying signals that they're sending via social media. It also uses natural language processing, one of my favorite parts, to intelligently and automatically know the difference between similar statements such as, this app has never been good versus, this app has never been this good. Now, the engaging component is the second aspect of SAP's social media solution service. It helps you improve customer support by allowing you to set rules about which messages to route to whom and how they should be dealt with. For example, if someone tweets a message about technical support problems, you can get it to the right person and fix their problems through social media. SAP social media solutions from SAP give you an accurate and real-time understanding of your brand's social media performance. Now, if you manage social media presence for a large or regional or national enterprise, get in touch with SAP now. You can find out more at sap.com/twit. And we thank SAP for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, you've done it again. You've used another hour listening to This Week in Enterprise Tech. I want to give our guest a chance to shout out and tell us what they're working on. Oliver, you first. What's going on? What do you want our audience to know about?
Well, currently we're doing some nice how-to articles on the InfoWorld site. I am actually working on that article about how to deploy Windows 8 in 30 minutes or less off a USB stick with everything that you want on there. And there'll be some others. If I had the calendar in front of me, I could tell you which ones, but I don't.
Well, definitely look forward to that. I'd love to install Windows 8 in 30 minutes or less. Chibert, yes. What about you? Anything as exciting as a half-hour deployment of Windows 8?
Actually, no. Oliver.
Sorry.
Now, lots of things happening. Give a shout out to the folks at ThinLinks. I'm meeting with the CEO in a few minutes. Anyway, I'm actually having a lot of fun building a enterprise toolkit story for InfoWorld also. And basically, it's going to be documenting all the cool things that go into my toolkit, both physical and logical. Things like a live distro of Linux that literally has hundreds of toolkits from password crackers to partition managers, to cloning tools and things like that, all the way over to a OpenGear terminal console server that I carry around so that I can leave something in the closet and do remote work. Look for that hopefully in about a week or two on InfoWorld.
Fantastic. We also want to have an appeal here to you, the audience, because we're starting up a new series of episodes for TWiET. It's Q&A. It's all about you. The questions that you have about enterprise-class networking, about gear, about software, about services, or just about what goes on in an enterprise. And we finally figured out a use for our Reddit page. You can submit your questions now. Go to twiet.reddit.com. Add your questions. Hopefully there'll be a little bit of discussion about which questions should be answered. And we will start having episodes of TWiET dedicated just to you, our devoted listeners, our loyal followers, the TWiET Army. Also, I'd like for you to subscribe to this show on iTunes. If you're just listening to it now, you can go to our page at twit.tv/TWiET and subscribe to the iTunes feed or to any feed that you want to keep getting your TWiET goodness. Now, you're probably listening to this first as an audio podcast, but it's even better in video. So let me suggest this. If you're listening to us in the car, if you're listening to us on the train, on a bike ride, on a walk to work today, download the video just to find out what it adds, what you can see, the visual aids, our guests. It's quite a production. And, well, you know, we do it for you. So why not take advantage? Also, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com /PadreSJ. If you follow me on my Twitter feed, you'll be able to find out what we're doing in future episodes of TWiET. You'll be able to ask for particular topics, particular segments of stuff my IT guy says or the data closet. And you'll be able to find out what the digital Jesuit does when he's not messing around at the Brick House. Also, please come and join us here live in the Brick House and on the chat room. We tape every Monday at noon Pacific time. You'll be able to jump into the chat room and speak to some of the most brilliant people that you've ever met, people with years and years of experience, people like Curtis B., who writes all the music for all of our TWiET segments, people like CyberDog, who has been bugging me for the last couple of weeks to give him access to the wiki page so that he can update our show notes so that you can go in and find the information that you want to find. Finally, I want to thank everyone here at the Brick House, everyone from Jason to Karsten, my TD, my producer, everyone who's built the brand new set for TWiET, which we will be on next week, to Ergotron for giving us all the wonderfully possessed stands, and, you know, just make sure that you keep watching. I'm Father Robert, this is TWiET, and remember, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep TWiET.